I've never shared this with anybody publicly. There's so many things happening in this conversation right now. 1,000 years from now, people are going to be looking at this podcast saying, so this was the breakthrough.
If this was SportsCenter, that would be like such a hot take. Skip Bayless would have no idea. Stephen A. Smith would have no idea what to say if you drop that down. That is so good.
The joke I always say is like, how'd you learn so much? You got to drink a lot.
The power of food and beverage to lubricate an environment.
Resistance to change is hurting the church.
I'm not in the camp that God has a penis or a vagina or a body at all. I'm in the camp that God is a universal spirit.
This is the strangest podcast that I have been on. I don't even know what to do.
I'm kind of geeked up about this wine.
You've uncovered the mystery. You've exposed the formula.
You've just duct taped together a number of things that aren't normally hanging out together, and I'm here for it.
We're going to sit down at a table. We're going to have a glass of wine and some food, and we're going to talk about the beauty of Jesus.
Thank you for the hospitality that this particular podcast provides folks like myself, and I know others, to be curious around their faith practices.
I will never forget the first time I bought a bottle of wine by myself, which was yesterday.
By the way, drinking this Pinot Grigio at 3 o'clock in the afternoon is making me even more direct in my communication than I normally would be.
Welcome to episode 2. Today I'm joined with a guest. I'm so excited. We're going to have so much fun. This Cabernet and Pray began last week starting us off, and now we get to have some fun with one of my favorite people. This guy is so incredible. His name's Tyler Johnson. He's been a friend of mine for a long time. Before I bring him in, I want to just give you a little intro so you can set the stage of what kind of a guy we're dealing with here. He's originally from Denver, Colorado. He loves Colorado. Played baseball at Arizona State University, which is legit. He's been married to Haley for 21 years. They have 4 kids, a 17-year-old, 16-year-old, 12-year-old, 11-year-old. All of them are athletes. You're starting to notice a trend here. He's a spiritual and social entrepreneur just now entering into the marketplace, started a business called The Human Element. Ladies and gentlemen, my friend, Tyler Johnson. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, man. How are you?
I'm great. For those of you who are just listening to the audio version of this, you can't see, but Tyler is somewhere up north. He's rocking cabin vibes behind him. So where are you at right now?
I'm in Flagstaff, Arizona, which is very nice to get out of the heat.
You're a smart one. I am not in Flagstaff, so the rest of us will rough it for you. All right, Tyler, anything else we need to know about you that didn't make the intro list?
No, that's pretty good. I'm an active dad with 4 kids, as you said, that are all active in sports. So we're driving everywhere. My wife constantly says she's the unpaid Uber driver. So that's our life. Like many people's.
Many, many parents can relate to that feeling. Well, before we begin,
many can relate.
I have a sound effect to play, which means it's time to drink some wine. So I'm going to start us off. I'm going to share what I'm drinking today, and then we're going to find out what Tyler's drinking. So today I am drinking a 2021 Argyle Neuhaus Riesling, which is just a fun wine to talk about. Now, Riesling, I want to just throw it out there, I think is one of the most underrated white grapes that you may or may not have in your repertoire. Riesling can be made in all levels of sweetness. So sometimes people have like a sweet Riesling and they're like, oh, that was gross, I don't like that. But this is a very diverse grape and can do a whole lot. And the one I'm drinking right now is actually medium dry, so just a little bit of sweetness to it. And as I was tasting this earlier, amazing honeysuckle, apple notes. Because I'm not up north like Tyler is, this is very refreshing on a hot Arizona day. And Argyle is a winery that's actually right down the street from our rental home in Oregon. In fact, from our front porch of our wine home, you can see Argyle. And when they do like concerts and stuff, we can hear them from our front porch. So super cool that they offer an Oregon Riesling. That's what I'm drinking today. Tyler, what are you drinking?
I am drinking an Italian wine. So I love Italy. I was going to Italy at least twice a year. And I actually have a Farnetto Rosso Giandone is what it's called. And it's actually a fermented red wine, which I'd never had until I was in Italy. And they handed it to me and I tried it. So it's like a 2019, so not very old, but it is a very unique flavor and kind of steps back a little bit. Like, that's very unique and good. So I'm enjoying it as you enjoy your Riesling.
There we go. Love it. Okay. So Tyler, lately you have been sending me photos of wine bottles, and not just any wine bottles, but like really nice wine bottles. And you've been drinking these with some interesting people in some unique settings. Tell us a little bit about some of these bottles you've been sending me.
Yeah. So my best wine story, which you may get into lately, I've been actually drinking some old 1990s Zinfandels. We were into an 80s Cabernet the other day. There's a bunch of guys I know in the baseball world, which is something Jeremy, you and I have in common, is we both love baseball. But we, so I have some really good friends with the Dodgers, some guys that coach with that team, and they're huge wine guys. One of them's the manager, actually has his own vineyard and winery himself. So we'll get out there, and I've been out with them in San Diego and then recently in LA, and they'll always uncork really good bottles of wine. So knowing you love wine, I like to snap pictures, not so much for you to celebrate with me, but for you to be jealous. So it's fun to talk baseball and wine. That's right.
I get these photos from him. I'm just like, wow, that looks like a really good bottle, and that looks like a really good time. And
my buddy said to me the other day, because he uncorked it and I drank it, and I'm like, bro, this is incredible. And he's like, at what point are you going to stop saying this is incredible and just know we drink only great wine? So
have you got to the point yet? Because that's a great experience. But have you gone back and tried some really cheap wine? Like, you know, you're on a flight and hey, whatever red they give you, and have you noticed that your taste buds are changing or no?
Oh, very much. It's almost impossible to go back and drink cheap wine. It's what happened to me with coffee too, which is a problem typically for your pocketbook, both for coffee and for wine. But it's my taste buds have definitely changed.
That is a problem. If you do learn to acquire the taste of nice wine, you can't go back. So just be aware. If you have that experience, there's no going back. So we love baseball. Let's get it out there. This is a podcast about wine, but we need to set things straight. Why is baseball the greatest sport ever, Tyler?
Yeah, I mean, I love it. I grew up with it, so I love it because I grew up with it. But I think it's the best sport ever because there's an incredible amount of detail. There's unbelievable amounts of strategy. It's incredibly difficult. Most people that have studied this stuff would say hitting a baseball is one of the hardest things to do, if not the hardest thing to do in sports. So watching the level of skill and strategy, and the fact that it's a great sport for Americans because it necessitates more patience than any of us have anymore.
Yeah, and I love when people say, you know, that's such a boring game. It's such a boring sport. And there's so much thinking involved. And it's interesting, if you watch or listen to a game on TV or on the radio or whatever, they're explaining everything to you in real time. And if you go to a game, you have to try to make sense of what just happened, or what was that play, or why is that guy going to that base? And that's when you realize how complicated baseball is, when there's not an announcer in your ear literally explaining it. And I've become the dad at baseball games, that when like the other parents, you know, are asking the question, like, what, that kid just struck out, why is he on first base? Like, okay, let me explain. Yeah. Drop third strike, you know, like I just have to be that guy. But yeah, you're totally right. There's just so much to love.
It's gotten even more so with the whole, you know, the rise of Moneyball, which kind of made it famous. But the nature of analytics now, the level of strategy is amazing. And when you get in, there's all kinds of really cool websites. You can watch guys talking about this stuff now. But it's really fun when you get into it, because there's a level of detail and understanding of why certain moves are made. People complain a lot, especially historic baseball people, of why managers are pulling pitchers as early as they are. And it's all science is what it is. It's literally analytics that they just, it's matchups and how it works, which is pretty fun.
It is fun to mix the, I have a gut feeling about this with, here's what the charts show, and try to blend those things together.
That's exactly right.
Okay, Tyler, when I was thinking about early on, like, who do I want to have conversations with, you immediately came to mind, partly because you and I have been having quite a few conversations recently about your life. There's mm-hmm. been a lot going on for you, and we've been talking through it. And I just asked you if you would be comfortable sharing some of that journey or whatever, to whatever degree you feel comfortable. For those who don't know, Tyler was the lead pastor of a multi-site, multi-congregation church in Arizona, and recently decided that that's not what he wanted to keep doing. So we just stepped away from that. And I would just love, to whatever degree you feel comfortable, share a little bit of that journey, because this was not a short run for you in that role. You did it for many years, and obviously a lot of thought went into why you don't want to do it anymore. And I think it's really insightful for all of us to kind of hear from someone who's been deeply in the trenches and now, you know, has decided to do something else. What's going on? What's your thought process and all that?
So I have my whole adult life, professionally, I've been in this world of ministry, which is unique to start with, because I didn't grow up in it. I didn't grow up in the church at all. So even when the professional decision to be in church work and in the faith sector, if you will, was a real shift and challenge for me. I've been around baseball my whole life. So my father's a really prominent amateur baseball coach. I thought I'd be in baseball as long as I could be, that I'd play as long as I could, and then end up in a coaching realm like he was. And when these options came to me, Jesus had kind of gotten really real to me, and it was a wrestle with me to think about professionally working in the church space. And yet everything kind of just snowballed and it happened. And it was a great experience. I mean, it's over 20 years. My first job out of college was July of 2001. And I went in professionally on staff at the church that I ended up leading, and it changed names. There was a merger of the churches, launching the multi-congregational network. But really, I think the die got cast on my transition a while ago. And I'm not certain I could pinpoint a day and time, but I do think you begin to hit your late 30s and 40s. And whether you're consciously or subconsciously knowing it, you're asking these questions about your preferred future and what do you really want. And there are some factors when you're in faith and church space that are complicated. There's a lot of complications around the nature of a big organization. You're leading multi-million dollar organizations. So people would talk about the business dynamics. There's dynamics of that have a lots of parts of it that are enjoyable, and then a lot of parts of it that are very disorienting to think through how you're giving shape to Jesus and trying to show people Jesus and form people in the Jesus way of life. And you have all of these leadership responsibilities, and they're webbed together like this. That's complicated. And so you start having some internal wrestles. Then there's a lot of that work that really does, I don't know any other way to say it, but it does isolate you or extract you out of a lot of the warp and woof of other things in culture. And so a lot of times you start looking at people that you're leading that are inside your church and beginning to go, I wonder what their life's like as a medical sales device person. I wonder what it's like to engage with these people as a teacher that have all different types of stripes of kids in the midst there. I wonder what it's like to serve as a public servant. And you end up kind of having these moments. I started having these moments of a little bit of fantasizing of it. And it's hard to not say it this way of like, what does it look like to just live a real life as a real person, follow Jesus in pursuit of that, which is not a downgrade on pastors. I mean, I've been one my whole entire adult life, but there was something in me churning. And then I would say the biggest factor for me in business, there's this book called The Blue Ocean Strategy, which is basically there's this huge blue ocean of opportunity that we can go after, but everybody seems to go after the same thing. And Jesus has a line like that where he talks about this field that's white for harvest. And I just began to be very compelled to say, I'd rather spend my time in a wider lane that has more complexity, more surprise, many more people of difference. And so, like I said, the die was cast. I made the decision just recently. There was a definite push-pull factor to it, meaning there were things pushing me out and things pulling me out. But yeah, I mean, that's the general rule is me looking at my future and just saying, as I think about a preferred future, I grew in certainty that I didn't want it to be there.
Mm. Now, I think what might be surprising for some people is in your position, you know, with a leadership role and in so many local different churches, that would seem to be, I think from the outside, at least, a very wide possibility for you. Like, well, you know, what is it you couldn't do with that? You have influence in all these churches. Isn't that kind of the pinnacle of what you can do? Why was that model limiting? Why did you feel like, hey, I can't actually do some of these things? Speak to maybe some of the complications of the
church. Yeah, so there is complications. And I would be amiss to not also say there is a moment you lead inside where you begin to realize where you want to take something may either be where they don't necessarily want to go or they don't want to go as far as you'd want to go. And there's a moment where you just go, because of all of these varying factors, I'm not the person to lead this anymore. So it's not even just they're so bad, but you start going, I'm not fit to do this anymore. And for me, the limiting factors of I'm very curious about culture, about different kinds of people. I love crossing barriers and boundaries. And when you're leading Christian communities, there's a lot of people that's disruptive to. There's also a lot of people that go, is that the job you should be doing? The job of pastor is to care about those inside. And if not, go out. There's some pretty specific visions of what would be called evangelism. Go out. You can go out and share these things. But the idea of really doing life with people that are widely different, intense curiosity, starting at points of like, bold, courageous conversations, but also a lot on like what's called appreciative inquiry, the idea of like, how do I see in these people lots of levels of appreciation? And that just adds a lot of complexity. I mean, it'd be a little bit at times, I'll give you an image. It can feel to people like if you were leading a restaurant that was a bistro, an American bistro, and you started going, you know what, I want to start serving Chinese food. And they're going, no, we're a bistro. Like, we're a bistro and you're trying to serve Chinese food. Well, if you're the chef of that restaurant, you go, well, my vision has always been to have a restaurant of multiple cuisines. You have this moment where you start wrestling with like, am I trying to do something new in a shell that didn't sign up for that? They didn't say. So those are the things I had to start wrestling with, is these things have been in me a really long time. I don't feel like these have been hidden things necessarily, but I would like to do this. And you start asking yourself questions like, maybe this really isn't. Jesus uses this language of when new things are going to be done. Interesting that we're on a podcast about wine, but he talks about if you take old wine and pour it into new wineskins, or new wine into old wineskins, you can burst the wineskin. And I started asking a lot of the new going into the old and bursting it of like, are you just screwing the whole thing up in the midst of what's you're trying to do, what tried to happen? Does there need to be a different container? And in that image for me, the container was just my profession. The first part of deciding, I do think I'm coming to a point where whatever it is I want to pour into this, this isn't the container. I'm supposed to be the one. As far as what I'm pouring, I'm not supposed to continue to pour it into this container.
That new wineskin image takes on a whole different connotation with the restaurant analogy, you know, of bringing the Chinese food into the bistro and you break the Chinese restaurant. Well, you know, like,
yeah, that's right.
That's really good. I like that. Okay. So I have some similarities with your journey, obviously a lot that's different. what are the emotions that this journey has been like for you? Is this, you know, you say it so logically and, you know, like, oh, well, that, of course, that makes sense. But you're a human and, you know, these are deep relationships and it's complicated. Just what have you felt along this road? What would you say have been maybe some of the dominant emotions that you've experienced?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things in the journey for myself in transition of something you've done that's very community oriented. I mean, it's a people oriented industry, if you're willing to use that word. Best friends, families, wildly involved with each other. Because I'm not short on convictions, so I have a lot of convictions about a lot of things, and where I aspired and desired to see our churches go, where there might be resistance, there was definite sadness to it. There's sadness both to like whatever it was that you weren't able to accomplish. There was sadness over what I feel like were failures in my own leadership. Then there was just sadness that it couldn't happen. Then you have all the relational sadness of, there's just a reality in real life of proximity matters. And when you start going, I'm not going to be as proximate to these people, I'm not going to see them, that's sad. The other part is when you know there's people you've had great relationships for a really long time that you don't agree on a lot of stuff. And at some points, people are really mad at you. That's an awkward thing to navigate. People feel like your leadership was poor. That's an awkward thing to navigate. So yeah, I mean, one of the things I've had to really work on is getting out of my head, because I can be logical and I think I have a human first approach to understanding a lot. So I can rationalize a lot. And there was seasons of this journey, because it's been multiple years in the making, that were more disorienting than others. And one of the things I would say a lot, because you just said this about you sound so rational, is I'd say my head can make sense of this, my heart can't. And I've been challenged recently to say, you're trying to make so much sense of this in your head. Maybe you should actually trust your intuition and feelings more than even your thoughts, about what this is. And that's, whether or not people agree with that as they're listening to it, it was really good for me to begin to go, when you're kind of trying to live out a whole reality of who you are, and you know, there's this word of embodiment, making it make sense holistically through who I am, not just rationally in my head. So that's why I appreciate your question.
Yeah, that's so good. And, you know, I think to go back to your analogy, you as the chef maybe had hopes and an energy that you could serve different food. And so, you know, when you realize that's not going to be a reality, there is that sense of sadness and almost a grieving, you know, in my experience of, this could have been something that I would have been really excited about. And for a variety of reasons, it's not going to be that. And so you almost have to let that dream die so that, you know, these things that God has planted in you, these excitements, these convictions, to use your word, they're able to be manifest in new ways. And now you're, you know, you've ended one season very nobly and a tremendous amount of courage. I just will say publicly, I've said this to you, you know, to your face, but just immensely respect you for how you have led for many years and for how you're handling this season of transition, where you're right, it's an awkward thing to be in that seat and have the criticism aimed at you, because this isn't what I thought it should be. And I don't understand why can't you just keep serving Chinese food? Well, I feel like there's something else, or why can't you just be the bistro, or, you know, whatever it is. I really admire how you've done that. So for all of us in evangelicalism or whatever we're in, thank you.
That's one of the things about this that's so, I'll just say this quick, but that is confusing, maybe the word. I don't know if disorienting is too strong or not. It feels disorienting. But is when you go, I know we could get there. I know we could do this. And you go, and I think it's really important. So it isn't just like, hey, I have a creative itch I want to scratch. And you all are going to be pulses of what this is, but these senses of like, there's a way you understand the kingdom. There's a way you understand the context that you're living in. There's a way you understand leadership. And when those things begin to be pressed upon and they get very personified to you, it's a deep internal wrestling match for sure.
One of the things that has come out of your convictions is something I introduced called the human element. Why don't you tell us a little bit more? What is that?
Yeah. So as a concept, it's basically saying there's various forms of capital. The one you think about all the time is financial capital, and there's different kinds of assets and liabilities when you begin to think about money. But really trying to say the most potent form of capital any leader ever has is the people. And every dynamic of what we study, of let's say it's cultural intelligence, relational intelligence, even down the line to like P&L sheets at the core, when you get underneath it, is about human interaction. Economies are about human interaction. So the human element is just saying, especially in a world that's in all these emerging technologies, AI and robotics, so we have, and the most potent form of capital is human beings. And that's the human element, which I would say is your greatest competitive advantage.
So what do you do with that?
So I have started a company that really falls in the front. It's essentially an organization on strategy and execution, but it gets as zeroed in on working leader to leader, of helping leaders find out, you know, learn themselves, learn who they are, not just as leaders, but as humans, and then how to activate in their leadership or complex problems inside of organizations, which could be crisis management. It could be specifically they're looking for strategies that would be more human-centered. So it's an organization that essentially says you have, if you drew a circle with like a Mercedes emblem, and one of the triangles of the Mercedes emblem would be your specific industry focus. So if it's an engineer, you're an engineer. I would shade that out and go, I'm not an engineer. I don't claim to be an engineer. I don't have the experience or expertise. You have an engineering. Another part of it would be actual money. All the money that goes into this, you have to figure all that out. But where it's people, this is where we'd enter in and go, we think we have background, experience, and expertise to be experts in human nature. And so when you get into this, let's have a conversation around how all of your struggles at a core level seem to be human struggles. So I'll give an example. When I've met with some professional sports teams, coaches, or some front office people, it's always incredible to me how they spend so much money on data and analytics. One, they spend so much money on training the physical bodies of the athletes and developing routines, and then strategy on game planning related to both of those. But when push comes to shove and they come back and drink wine, what they're talking about fundamentally is the human challenge. Why did this person see the information they had and still shake off the catcher and throw a pitch we told him not to throw? Well, you get in and you go, well, there's something fundamental in what it means to be human. When a human receives information of don't throw that pitch, they're hearing you're not good enough in that. When you add human nature, doesn't like to be confronted with something they're not good at, and they want to prove to you they are, they now throw a pitch they weren't supposed to throw in baseball, give up a home run. Why does that happen? That's the angst. So typically a leader would complain about that, would be frustrated about that. There'd be gossip in the center circles of whatever the leadership cult. When you take a perspective of the human element, you humanize a situation and then begin to build strategies according to human nature for greater execution of what you'd want to do. But it is, my experience is that's rare because it takes time. It takes a lot of conversation that most people don't want to live in. They want efficiencies to get them there and yet continue to have the same problems, the same conversations over and over and over.
It sounds like it's a great application of empathy.
Yeah. I mean, I think empathy is a substantial part of what this is. One of the things I use is this idea of multi-form intelligence. And one of the components of that is relational intelligence, which emotional intelligence, which empathy is a huge part of, would be a part of it. But also cultural intelligence begins to be a huge part of that because people are working with people from vastly different backgrounds than they have. But it is a huge exercise in empathy.
And I love, you know, you could approach the pitcher and say, here's our analytics. Here's why we told you not to throw that pitch. Or you could say, hey, how are you doing? You know, what's going on right now?
Totally right.
You're suggesting the let's treat them like a human first, not, you know, you're just the product of these analytics. And yeah, I think that's powerful. Obviously works in sports, but that has huge implications for every arena of life, it would seem.
For sure. I mean, if you took it out of the athletic arena and just put it into whatever arena, it's a person coming in to evaluate a teacher and go, why did we do this evaluation? And the next time we're in here, you're doing the same thing. It's not always as easy as like, they're obstinate and don't want to do it. And again, I don't want to be a pure optimist. I mean, there's certain points people are obstinate and do go, I don't want to hear it from you. But a lot of times it's just the complexity in human nature is far more, it's far more complex and interesting if we're willing to engage with it.
I love that. It also applies to parenting as I'm listening to you talk.
A whole lot.
Yeah. Yes. Like, why are you doing what you're doing right now? You are passionate about ecumenism. And this is something that's not on the radar for most Christians. Many Christians probably have no idea what this word even means. I'll give us a working definition. Ecumenism is the belief that the different Christian churches should be as united as possible, kind of a vague way of understanding it. Why would you say that is such a value and passion for you?
I mean, on one hand, if you just go the Bible, Jesus has this prayer where he's praying for the oneness of all of his followers so that the world would know how relevant Jesus really is, that the world would know that God had sent Jesus into the world. So that's the passage that gets referred to a lot in the midst of it. There's another part of that of why I think that's true is there is this sense of the, and the Apostle Paul talks about this in the book of Ephesians, of this manifold wisdom of God, which is this like multicolored nature of who God is expressed in diversity. So this idea of distinct, equal, and one is humanity. And so there's a lot of appeals out there by some Christian leaders, Pope Francis being one, around human beings walking in social friendship and in fraternity. But when it comes to Christians, it's the notion of being curious and believing that the genius is inside the total whole of the body of Christ, not just in one part of it. My experience with it is I have grown deeper in my faith the more I've been around Christians of difference from me, of different theological beliefs, different cultural beliefs, different historic Christian traditions in the midst of it. So there's a better in the sense of like better together. If we were together, collective impact, that's true. Then there's like a better in the brilliance of what you don't know. So when you begin to explore and see what you don't know, you get stunned by it and see the beauty inside so many of these traditions. So I am deeply passionate about it. I do think the division's a massive problem inside the Christian church. And I think the ones that lose is us at a very core level of the opportunity to just see far, far deeper the brilliance of God than we've ever seen before.
Now speak, because I know a little bit of this history, speak to this. This was one of the menu items, I think, for you to use your restaurant analogy. This is a dish you were trying to bring in and was very tough in the reception. What was that like when you tried to make this a value in real time?
Well, anything. One, we had 10 churches inside of our one church, 10 congregations, we would call them. Even inside each church, there's different people who receive these things very differently. So a couple who came out of, let's say, a mixed marriage, meaning one was Roman Catholic, one was Protestant, ended up love it. I mean, they're fascinated by it. It helps them understand their families. Some of the biggest resistors to it in our world, which was a Protestant church, were people who had become kind of more Protestant or evangelical out of Roman Catholic backgrounds because they'd had really poor backgrounds inside their Roman. Even in that, if you take the human side of it, you have to remember there's also a lot of evangelicals becoming Roman Catholics. So there's this dual highway of people crossing each other's paths along the way. But the opposition at the core level is in our, in the worlds I was in, for so long have been told the other historic Christian traditions aren't biblical, maybe even not Christian. So it gets very disoriented to people when you're going to sit down at a table and go, we're going to talk about Jesus and how you love Jesus and how we love Jesus. To some, it feels like you're compromising the core convictions of what you've told them and or taught them for a long period of time. I clearly don't believe that. And I don't believe it's up to me to do the work that I think only God can do to go, who actually believes in Jesus, who actually is following Jesus. All I can do is kind of take people at their word and say, you're saying it. I know there's scriptures in the Bible that say your life should match the one you say you follow. That's all true. But when it comes down to like the deep visceral opposition, who's a Christian and who's not a Christian, that's a bit outside of my pay grade. So for me, it's as simple as like, even in the end, if many people say that are Protestants, let's say evangelicals, we don't think Roman Catholics are Christians, or there's a lot of Roman Catholics who don't think Protestants are Christians. To me, it feels so ironic that sitting at a table talking about Jesus could create that much controversy, because it's like, well, don't you think that would be a good thing? Like maybe their eyes would be open to the real Jesus in the framework you're in. Maybe. So to me, it feels like a very safe game, if you will, to go, hey, we're going to sit down at a table. We're going to have a glass of wine and some food, and we're going to talk about the beauty of Jesus. It's been an incredible experience for me, but at the level of opposition, this is where I felt like there was moments where, yeah, I felt crazy. Like, am I nuts or does this feel crazy? Because this doesn't seem as problematic as some people really feel like it is.
So I think one of the challenges, because I would say I found a very similar reaction in my ministry experience as well. One of the challenges I think in real time for people is, yeah, you're saying we are united on Jesus. Great. But what we're not united on is X, Y, and Z that I believe over here, and they believe this differently. And I think for many people, they don't know how to live in that tension where you're saying you follow Jesus, but you don't follow Jesus the exact same way I do. How do you help someone who's struggling in that, who's saying, how do I get over the X, Y, and Z that we disagree on, even though we agree on Jesus? Have you found any way to kind of nudge someone along or say, hey, this is a really helpful way of thinking about that?
Yeah, I mean, my answer to that would be, let's start sitting at a table. So the community I've been doing a lot of this work with uses this line of start with the feet, not with the head. Meaning it's an image of when Jesus washed the disciples' feet. So if you start in service and in relationship, a lot can become a surprise to you. So this, I have this real strong conviction that people most often are the center of surprise. That if you want to be surprised, sit at a table, serve somebody, ask good questions, even about your disagreements. And my experiences and what I've heard of many other people when I've been in these environments is, they're stunned by what they thought these people believed compared to what they believed. And so the starting point is to perceive like, hey, I think we have a disagreement here. It seems like it's a significant one. Can you tell me what you believe about Mary? Can you tell me what you believe about how somebody comes to faith in Jesus? Can you tell me what you believe about the Pope? Well, pretty soon, and I'm using only Roman Catholic examples, it would be very similar with Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox Christians. What's pretty soon is a lot of times they start answering in a way where you go, wow, that doesn't even feel that different than what I thought.
or it's really different than what I thought you thought. And then at other points, what you realize is they're not dumb. They have Bible verses to support these things. We're talking about ecumenism. They have Bible verses. They have deep amounts of thought about it. They have challenges to you. And even if you walk out, which I've done hundreds of times, like I still don't agree with them, but I walk out with far more respect and a strong sense of like, listen, that isn't unorthodox and it isn't unnecessarily like unbiblical to the level that would be wildly concerning. And sometimes it is. I mean, Jeremy, sometimes I go, wow, that feels really problematic. Like and then I walk out and go, that feels really problematic, but that person's pretty interesting. And then I walk out and go, and this builds my faith. I walk out and go, God, I don't know what to do with all that, but I thank God I don't have to fix it because you start realizing like these people aren't dumb. They have deep rooted convictions that I may even deeply disagree with. But then you start going these trite, like slogan mantras that you think is going to like prove your point and change their mind just doesn't happen. So then I go, let's say it was something I really did feel burdened by and wanted to change their mind. Then the question of like, how do paradigm shifts actually happen? And I think they happen in the context of relationship and in the context of love, not in the context predominantly in debate. I'm not saying no one's ever changed their mind in a debate, but I think long-standing real shifts happen in relationship. And by, I'll just say one more line. You can get somebody to agree with you in a moment, maybe just because you're being a jerk. Like, and they're like, just get me out of here. I'll say anything to just get out of this conversation because this person is annoying. Well, that's not what would, if it concerns you at a deep level, you're not looking for just cognitive assent, but an honest shift of a change of mind. And I think that happens in the context of love and relationship far more than it does verbal battery.
Or social media battle.
Or social media battles. Yeah, that's exactly right.
All right, that's typing a good battery time for us to take a little drink break. You've already talked about drinking wine with baseball players. What is your favorite? If you had to pick a memory, maybe first thing to come to mind or the last great one you had, if you've got tons of them, a favorite wine experience, what was it? Why was it so amazing?
So one of my best friends in the world got the bench coach job with the New York Yankees when Aaron Boone became the manager. And so you got to understand, this is not me trying to name drop. I love baseball, my best friend in the world, and I love food and wine. And they took me to a place. So the New York Yankees do their spring training in Tampa, Florida. And there's a place called Burns Steakhouse, which is the largest wine library in the nation. So, I mean, it's a book that's like this. It's basically like the Dewey Decimal System, literally. They have cataloged their wines according to the Dewey Decimal System because the cellar is so massive. You can see a portion of it, but then the majority of it, I mean, you could look it up how many of them was. So I'm literally sitting, eating steak and drinking a 1972 Zinfandel. So what? I'm not young. And that's 5 years before I was born. I was born in 1977. And I'm sitting there the whole time like, is this real? You're a Yankees fan. I'm not a huge Yankees fan. I don't hate the Yankees, but I sat there the whole time. Like, you're talking baseball, the power of wine. I have a really good friend in the restaurant industry, and he talks about the power of food and beverage to lubricate an environment. Totally. And some of the best friendship moments I've had have been like that. So that night, the dining experience was insane. The wine was insane. They have a separate dessert room that you sit in wine barrel caskets, like big wine caskets are the seats so that they've put them inside. So the whole experience was just absurd. I mean, absolutely absurd. And I didn't have to pay for it. So that made it even better. But the 1972 wine was So if you add wine, friends, and good ambiance and food, a lot of laughter and talking about baseball, that's a recipe for success in my book.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. That's a good time. Okay. So you had issues, we'll say, trying to bring Christians together with other Christians. Okay. But you go further than that. You also are passionate about uniting people of different religions, which if people have a hard time on the first, they're usually really going to have a hard time.
Yeah.
You know, why on earth would we try to spend time, you know, with other religions? Why is that a passion for you? What have you seen in that?
Yeah. So let me just start and say, I don't think they're the same thing, but it is the same strategy and methodology, okay, which is relationship. So, you know, if to walk in and say to a Muslim, we're basically the same thing, is offensive to a lot of Muslims. Mm-hmm. It's offensive to a Jew. Like, you know, I mean, I've had a rabbi say to me, listen, I'm not a Christian, which is different than when you're sitting with a Roman Catholic and with a Orthodox person who all affirm the historic Christian creeds going, listen, we all believe in Jesus. Those are not the same things.
Sure.
And yet we live in the same world. And so one of my favorite lines is, if you boil it all down and Jesus says the greatest commandments to love God with all your everything and love your neighbor as yourself, if that's the center of it is loving your neighbor as yourself, which we could get in a long conversation about the number of times that gets boiled down only to that statement, love your neighbor as yourself, because I think it's the means we love God. You can't love your neighbor if you don't know your neighbor. Hmm. And there are tons of our neighbors who are not the same religion as we are. They don't have the same, what philosophers would call first principles, whether that's atheists, agnostics, Hindus, Muslims, a variety of stripes, Jews, a variety of stripes, Zoroastrianism, whatever it might be, they don't. And yet I'm called to love my neighbor. So what's very interesting is I can't love them if I don't know them. And then you get into like, even I made this statement earlier about the human element, but when you study economics and economies, economies thrive where there's trust. So even in a capitalist society like ours that wants to advance economic impact, social trust is so massively important to a flourishing economy, which I think economics means way more than just money. But people don't begin to interact money. It's the old adage of like, people do business with people they trust. You use Yelp because people are giving you a recommendation, which makes you trust the restaurant you just chose more because a variety of people are there. Well, if social fabric and trust is so important, and as a Christian, I'm called to love my neighbor, I'm doing active work towards living out my faith of Jesus in getting to know my neighbor. And I think I'm loving all my other neighbors by building social trust amongst religions of difference. So when there isn't trust, at the most dramatic level, you have terrorist attacks. You have bombings of cities that happen, and then always be like the other, here's the other person. So when you're sitting, and this is what I mean by the strategy, and you're pulling people together at tables. So I've been in retreats, like going away with imams, which is like a Muslim leader, a clerical leader, like a Muslim pastor. So imams, rabbis that are leading synagogues of Judaism, and we'll literally sit in rooms. A lot of Muslims, most Muslims don't drink alcohol. Some people be drinking alcohol. I've been at a dude ranch in Texas where people are shooting skeet and watching, riding horses together. And the whole point is to be human beings together. And you start realizing fast, we have far more in common as human beings than we do differences. But then it gets to these really interesting, if you're willing to honor people's deep level of convictions and not always go, well, we're basically the same thing. I'm not opposed to those moments, but when you can go, we have a ton in common as human beings. Now I want to talk about the differences. they're some of the most robust conversations I've ever had in my life, because many of these people have beliefs that in believing what you believe, it's an eternal problem for you. People would call it hell. Muslims call it the hellfire. So you get in these very emotionally charged, in a good way, passionate conversations about deep-rooted beliefs. And it's just, it's fun. It's fascinating. It's fun. I've developed incredible friendships, had amazing opportunities. And I believe it's about way more than my incredible experience. It's about our kids are going to school with kids that are massively different. And if we can help them work together, far more can be accomplished in society. Far more can be accomplished in businesses, business partnerships. And then ultimately, that's the positive. You're also combating the negatives, is when people don't know each other, they typically fill the gap in pathological ways and do crazy stuff, even to the point of murder.
So you frame this with, this is a way to live out Jesus's command to love your neighbor. Would you then say, you know, because I can imagine some Christians hearing this and going, okay, great. If that's your thing, then, you know, meet with Muslims. But would you go further than that and say that there's a sense of obligation of, if you are following Jesus and you do want to love the other well, that this is something you should take a look at? Or how strongly, I guess, would you say that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel it pretty strongly. I mean, especially in the sense that I know you're called to love those in proximity of you. So if you take your physical neighborhood as an example, so there's two guys that are both good friends of mine, Dave Runyon and Jay Pathick, they wrote a book called The Art of Neighboring. And it's basically, what if Jesus is calling you to love your literal neighbor? Well, I know in tons of neighborhoods of people that I'm friends with in Arizona and the United States, they have a lot of diversity of belief in their literal neighbors. So to me, it would be, I think Jesus is calling us to have barrier crossing love with people. So yes, I would say that strongly. The other part is in love based upon what you believe. So in Islam, there's this concept called da'wah, which is, if you're a Christian, it's called evangelism, which means you are trying to get people to believe the way you believe because you think it's important. Short story, I'll tell you very quickly. When there was a gubernatorial race for governor in the state of Arizona some years ago now. So Ducey was 8 years. So this is about 10 years ago. There was a man named Fred Duval running against Doug Ducey. And the Democrats were asking all these questions because the evangelicals had begun to rise in the political climate. And I had an opportunity to go in and talk to the campaign headquarters for Fred Duval, a Democratic candidate for governor. And they were asking me to speak on what is an evangelical. And there's this historic quadrilateral by a guy named David Bebbington, Bebbington's Quadrilateral, where he talks about what an evangelical is in four ways. So they emphasize the cross, the Bible's the word of God, social action, and then one of them's evangelism. And I said, I know when I say evangelism, your guy's skin crawls right now. But the truth is, this campaign headquarters exists because of evangelistic-like belief. You believe Arizona would be better going blue than it would be going red. That's why you exist. You're trying to persuade people. I'm in the room because you're trying to persuade evangelicals to vote Democratic. So at the core level, when you have any deep conviction, you want to share it and persuade people to love wine, Cabernet and pray. I mean, part of it is going, you're trying to do that. So I don't necessarily think evangelism is a bad thing. I think it's a human thing. So even in that, when you get into the multi-faith conversations, I do, when I sit there and have led many of these, I'll say, will you give me two reasons why you'd sit at a table like this with people of big difference? My answers every time are, one, I follow Jesus and Jesus calls me to love my neighbor, and I can't love my neighbor if I don't know my neighbor, which I shared. And number two is, I really want you guys to see and to understand the beauty of Jesus, the way I see and understand the beauty of Jesus, which is evangelism. Some people are much more like, I've got 4 points. I'm going to share them because I want you to know Jesus. Even in that idea, you have to get in proximity with people to share Jesus with them. Now, I would argue you should do it in a far more relational context than sitting on the side of the road screaming. That's my opinion. That's a long answer to say, I could have just said, yes, I think people should. I think when you get around people different than you, whether they're Christians who are different than you, if you're a Christian, they're Muslims, they're Hindus, whatever, they're people that have piercings all over themselves, you will be stunned how amazing human beings are. Mm. If you're willing to sit and listen, hear stories, ask good questions, be far more, you know, as a Christian, practice this wisdom that comes of be quick to listen, slow to speak.
Yeah. I mean, it's the power of curiosity.
Yes.
That's so good, Tyler. One of the things that I love about you, and this is woven in between all of this, you have a heart for people in the margins and the people who get overlooked and the people who don't seem to get invited to these tables or these, you know, these conversations. And you've done it in a way, and this is why I admire you on a personal level, as I've seen it, you do it in a way that has cost you so that it's not just a theoretical, hey, I love them out there, but I'm going to invest whatever I can to try to, you know, to meet them. How has the idea of people on the margins in the way you understand the world and the way you understand society, how has that shaped you?
Yeah, massively. I mean, I couldn't answer that question without believing. I really do believe Jesus, looking at the person of Jesus, that Jesus is the clue and the key to the world. Like, I really do. So Martin Luther King Jr. had this statement where he said, love is the key that unlocks the door to ultimate reality. And if God is love and Jesus is God, when you're in Jesus, this is now the margins. If you really believe seeing the world through Jesus's eyes unlocks the door to ultimate reality, if you get inside of Jesus and look through his eyes, which interestingly enough is language that the New Testament uses over and over and over for those who have faith in Jesus, is that you're in Christ. If I'm looking through his eyes, who does Jesus always see first? If you're reading the Gospels, which was Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, and you go, who are the people that when the scene slows down are always in closest proximity to? And if you went, if I'm looking through Jesus' eyes, who do I see first? It's the woman who's bleeding. Even when he goes to Simon the Pharisee's house and the woman of the city comes in, he turns towards her. When the woman's caught in adultery, he gets low to see the world through her. And I just really believe you don't see reality unless you see first through the margins.
Mm.
Like I literally think it is impossible, which is even the nature of the way the Bible talks about the kingdom. The first will be last, the last will be first, is this ordering, which I do think is prioritization, which many people really struggle with that language. But there is a prioritization, I think, for this reason, because these people are never prioritized. But I think it goes even a step further, that it isn't just prioritize them because they're never prioritized, which is true, I think. There is something about reality that cannot be seen but through the lens of intense suffering and marginalization. Mm. I believe that to the core of my being, is that it orders reality in a way you never can if you're drinking wine with the chummies all the time.
That's powerful. And I love that you frame, you almost frame it for us, not just, oh, this is going to be an altruistic thing I can do, but almost you could internalize it of, this is a way for me to be more grounded in what is real and the way the world actually is. And so many of us run from that.
I think that's it. And what we don't run from is wanting life. So what we run to so often is to try to retain whatever life, even if it's life support we're on, is just keep it going. Or we run to alcohol, or we scroll our phone, ultimately to like take care of our anxiety, but to get as much life as we possibly can. So I like saying to people a lot, you want life that's worthy of the word. And I'll say capital L, capital I, capital F, capital E. Jesus says he came to give us life and give it to the full. And if you do what he says, so this is when he uses this famous thing at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, which is this very, is if you put these words into practice, you'll be like a wise builder. To me, that's the abundant life. So if I want life, it's so reality is what I was talking about, which I think is so true. But I do think there's this invite given to us in Jesus that I think all of us know in our bones, whether we believe in Jesus or we don't, is this fundamental belief that what many people would call altruism, that if I lived like that all the time, I would experience life and would be happier, which is what, you know, the Bible says this, like, remember the words of the Lord Jesus who said, it's more blessed, which is literally the word happy. You will be happier in giving than you will be in receiving. So it's an invite to reality and to happiness and to life. I believe that to the core of my being, but it's scary because we, you know, we're creatures of comfort. And a lot of times what reality is an exposure of where we have sickness inside of ourselves. And that's really hard for, you know, it's confirmation bias. I'd way rather have a bunch of people around confirming where I'm at rather than things exposing like, well, what if something really is wrong that I should really change? So
that's so good. Okay. I want to wind this down with a couple of questions I'm planning on asking every guest, whether they're in the ministry side or the wine side, just because this is these are human questions that I think we can all relate with. So first one is, what's the problem you're trying to solve in this new season of career, life, whatever?
Yeah, I'm having an image come to my mind, but the blockages in collective impact. So the human blockages to the power of what we can do together. I'd like to be a part of solving that problem where I can, is where people typically say, I'll never work with that person, to see the power of collective impact.
The human element, if you will.
The human element.
See what I did there?
I see what you did. Keep doing it, bro. That's marketing.
Thank you. Thank you. You plugged Cabernet and Prey, so I felt like I owed you. What's something you're excited about right now?
Yeah, I'm excited about starting this company. I really am. I'm excited about who I'm doing it with and having opportunities to do it with. You're at a stage of business development, so there's not a lot that I can talk about. But in business development, you end up in some spaces and around some people and projects. There's a couple projects that would kind of be in the public private partnership side or opportunities with some communities or cities that gets really exciting to me. That I feel like brings out a lot of the areas I've gained some experience in of interacting with different kinds of people. And to think that that could drive beyond a experience to real solutions, that excites me a lot.
That's awesome.
So
I'm excited to watch that develop for you. Okay. Anything you want to plug for our audience to check out, find more about things that you're working on?
Yeah, I mean, in the ecumenism area, John17movement.com, I think if you use the community I'm a part of, that I'd be very interested in people checking out. I'm also a part of a wider network called the Surge Network, which is an interesting community and group that really focuses multi-ethnicity in the church and a lot around the ecumenism stuff as well. And then go to MLB.com so that you can follow baseball, because Jeremy and I have both affirm it's worth it.
Literally before the episode, we're like talking about the latest roster updates and things like that, and trying to make sense of why the Yankees are so bad right now. It's brutal.
You know what is crazy about that, man, is they're not bad. I mean, people that have bad teams, can't stand people like you, because they're like, if this is bad, but they're just, they're not on pace to win a World Series, which for the Yankees is bad.
I mean, they're in last place. I'd say that's bad.
In the best division in baseball. But yes, sure, that is true.
But when you're sitting in the last place, hopes aren't high. So we're not talking World Series. We're talking, I don't think they're going to keep playing once everyone's done.
I don't think they will either, which is crazy. But
well, Tyler, seriously, this has been so good, and I love that, you know, new people are going to get exposed to these ideas and to your heart and to a different way of following Jesus and you know, kind of elevating the person of Jesus above a lot of the systems and things that sometimes we can get lost in. I love your phrase, start with the feet, not with the head. And, you know, there's so many ways we go about this. And then we go, yeah, it's not working, or this is the way it is. And Jesus is like, no, there's a better way to do it. And one of the things I'm just grateful for you and for your friendship is that you inspire that in me. You bring that out in me, and I'm better for that. So thanks for taking the time to do this. And dude, love you immensely, bro.
Love you, bro, a lot. Appreciate you a ton. So thank you.
All right, everybody, we'll be back next week with another guest, and we're going to go to the wine side of things. So we're going to explore some wine industry, and it's going to be a good time. So we will check you out next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for joining us for Cabernet and Pray. We'd love to hear what you thought of today's episode or what you'd like to see more of in the future. You can email us at cheers@communionwineco.com. And if you like this episode, please consider leaving us a 5-star review wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find us online at communionwineco.com.